liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Live from Oakland, California, it's We the People with Jerry Brown.
Welcome to another edition of We the People. This hour, we're going to get down to the basics, food, and how we produce it, how we should produce it, and how each one of us can have an impact on that aspect of our lives, which, as so many other things in the client state, is being removed from people into the hands of experts and professionals and distant bureaucrats and corporate managers who have arrogated to themselves the basics, whether it's dwelling or food production or schooling or healing or being born or birthing or dying. All this, of course, is now increasingly not the province of people themselves, but by a relatively privileged elite that like to govern as the masters of old. We the People likes to explode that false consciousness and ideology. And to help us do that today, on the subject of food and the production of food, we have two very interesting people right here in the studio. Miguel Altieri, hailing from Chile, but a person who's worked extensively in Cuba. He's now at the University of California in what used to be called the Department of Agriculture. It's now called what, Miguel?
It's the College of Natural Resources.
College of Natural Resources. This is very true now in the modern world. People like to change their names, but they rarely change their spots. I've noticed that, and I will ask you about the Department of Agriculture, which, as a fellow by the name of Von der Bosch many years ago,
it's a pesticide conspiracy,
had a lot to say about agriculture. And that voice you just heard was Peter Rossett, who is the president of Earth First.
Food First.
Earth First. Food First. What? It's all the same. It's against the grain. Not the same. Food First, and Food First, as you know, started many years ago with Frankie LePay, Francis Moore LePay, and who was the other co-founder?
Joseph Collins.
Joseph Collins, and they wrote a very famous book called Diet for a Small Planet. So, Peter, what could you give me a minute or two on Food First, what happened, or
well,
where
when,
it
when
is?
Well, when Frankie wrote Diet for a Small Planet, and it came out in the early 70s, was an international bestseller, sold 4 million copies in the U.S., it was translated into 28 languages. That really revolutionized a whole generation, made clear to people that food is something that's at once personal because it affects our bodies and our lifestyle, but also political because the people who grow our food, who are affected by the way it's grown, produced, distributed, all can be better off or worse off depending on how our food system is built. So as a result of the success of that book, she hooked up with Joseph Collins and they decided that there ought to be a people's think tank that looks at food and politics from the point of view of those who are normally left out of our economic system. And so they created the Institute for Food and Development Policy, which is more popularly known as Food First, based here in Oakland, California. And we are dedicated to the idea that we can transform society beginning with the way we eat and the way we produce food. And we use that as a window through which we examine countries, whether it's our own country or Chile or Mexico or Germany, look at any country and see who eats and who doesn't, who grows food and who doesn't have access to land, who benefits and who doesn't from the food system, and that will tell you a very large amount about a society and also will open doors or give you keys to change that society. And so Food First is basically a think tank. We work with a lot of alternative movements that are trying to change our society, bring in more social justice, always, in our case, from the food angle.
You know, I was looking in that respect. We grow food on the roof at the We the People Center, and I've had a lot of trouble with squash because we're just beginners here. And down the block is the wholesale produce district for the East Bay area. And I was walking by one night when the food came in just a few days ago, and I opened a box was open. I looked in, and there were these zucchinis, these some, I don't even know what the name of this, but these small squashes. Everyone was identical. They were perfect. And they come in these huge quarter of a million trucks that seem very, very long. They make huge amounts of noise in the middle of the night. But that system of getting food, mostly from Mexico, some from Southern California, it's going to be very hard for individuals themselves to compete with that.
Well, it is difficult because, of course, mass production in any industry leads to lower per unit costs. But that's if you don't take into account the true costs of that production. In the case of large-scale monoculture agriculture, it may look like each squash is cheaper, but that's because the agribusiness that produces it isn't paying for the full cost to society of pesticide contamination, fertilizer runoff, low wages for farm workers, small farmers displaced from the land, unhealthy food being eaten by consumers. So what seems cheap and difficult to compete with on one hand, and the other hand is really quite expensive. And I think one of the approaches here is to make agribusiness really address and pay for the full cost to society of the way food is produced. And that really sort of changes the whole economics of the
future. I also, I couldn't help but reflect about these particular vegetables. They were absolutely identical as far as I could tell. I mean, this was a well-organized group of beings. I mean, there was no deviance in this box. And I would say in nature that's relatively rare.
I would say that neither squash nor people were meant to be completely uniform.
So I did assume there was some definite intervention there, chemically or mechanically or something.
Genetically.
Is that how it was?
Because
I don't think I'd seen a squash that was so identical.
Yeah, what happens is that there's a whole group of plant breeders that are working to set up varieties of different crops that will be totally homogeneous in order to accommodate themselves to the production systems that corporations have to follow. So, for example, they all have the same growing period, they all mature at the same time, they all have the same size so that they can be picked mechanically, that displaces farm workers and so on. And that genetic homogeneity, basically what it does, it's makes the system highly vulnerable to diseases. And therefore, the need to put herbicides and fungicides and pesticides in order to keep those systems, from suffering epidemics, especially of diseases. And we have learned lessons already here in the United States back in the 70s with corn. There was a corn blight that basically because of the homogeneity, there were two varieties that were dominating the whole landscape of the United States. Dedicated to two varieties, and that genetic homogeneity left to vulnerability of diseases. So what we try to do in our approach, in what we call the agroecological approach, is basically to try to diversify farming systems utilizing mixed varieties or as much genetic diversity as possible. So the ideal would have to be to have squashes of different sizes, and that's basically what the peasants do in Mexico, where For example, cucurbita, which is the genus of squash, originated from. You will not find a peasant farmer, a small farmer, that will grow one variety of squash like the corporations do. They mix varieties, and that gives them the advantage of resisting diseases and adapting to the heterogeneous environments.
You have to wonder, the standardization of vegetables, whether or not it has an analog in terms of schooling in people.
Yeah, society that doesn't like people who come in different shades, colors, and shapes, and a society that doesn't like squashes that come in different sizes. It seems to be they both suffer from some kind of underlying systemic illness.
And then, of course, for the elite, because also in the same produce district, I've seen in at least last year, I didn't see them this year yet, boxes of these organic tomatoes of all conceivable shapes, colors, sizes, forms. And that, of course, is expensive, and that's for the elite.
Right. So, one of the things.
So, for if you can afford a $50 dinner, then you're going to get some really interesting food, and it's going to be grown locally, and it's going to be picked in season. But that's only for very wealthy people. Whereas this is actually peasant food for ordinary, at least in the normal course of human development. This should be just available to anybody.
Well, what's happening with organic agriculture is that. Yeah, it's becoming elitist because the only windows that they can afford is to have these specialty crops that are going to have premium prices because of the economics of scale. They would be displaced. Small, for example, organic farmers could not compete, for example, with a high, very large-scale producer of organic tomatoes. And so the way for them to be able to have economic opportunities to convert their systems, they have to take advantage of these windows that are provided by these very elitist economic groups. So that's part of our critique of organic farming.
Really, there's sort of two trends happening simultaneously. The dominant trend, which is depressing, is organic food being marketed increasingly by the same agribusiness companies that market the rest of our food, just with a higher price and targeted at elite consumers. The good news is that there are some grassroots trends going in the other direction that Miguel at the university and those of us at Food First are working hard to promote. And that's one of that is what's called community-supported agriculture, where you have consumers in urban areas linking up directly with small farmers and eliminating the middleman, meaning that organic food can be delivered to consumers at a lower price rather than a higher price. So that's a very positive trend that's growing throughout the country. And the other, of course, is urban agriculture, something which is very important here in the Bay Area, but throughout the U.S. and throughout the world. We see as people are increasingly left out of society and urban decay sets into inner-city neighborhoods, there are vacant lots that really nobody is taking advantage of, and increasingly we see people in poor neighborhoods beginning to farm those plots. There are dozens of urban farms here in the Bay Area and really all over the world, and that's another very positive trend. They usually use mostly organic methods, and then that food is directly available in the neediest neighborhoods.
Let me, Miguel, tell me a little bit about yourself now. I'd like to explore this subject, but I also want to find out, you studied in Chile?
Yeah, I studied in Chile agronomy, and then I left when the military coup happened in 1974, and I went to Colombia, and for the first time I was exposed to tropical agriculture and small farm agriculture. I saw for the first time farmers using polycultures, mixing varieties and mixing crops, and I also found that peasants or campesinos, as we call them in Spanish, have a rationale, have a knowledge about farming. Some of them in Latin America and in the Andes, for example, in Mesoamerica, have been farming for centuries. So there isn't much that we as scientists can teach them. Actually, it's the other way around. We got a lot to learn from them. Then I came to the United States. I did my PhD in the University of Florida. I came here in Berkeley in 1981 as a professor. And since 1987, I've been linked with several non-government organizations in Latin America that have been promoting what we call agroecology, which is basically an ecological approach to agriculture that is based on principles of modern science, but also on the principles of ethnoscience, which is the people's science, the farmer science that has emerged over centuries. And we have promoted, in collaboration with Food First and other groups, many, many projects where we are promoting food security, environmental preservation, and also cultural revival of traditions in many, many rural areas throughout Latin America.
Okay, I got you worked in Cuba too.
We have worked with Cuba, especially with Food First, since the transformation of the agriculture after the collapse with the Soviet relations.
Okay, I got two questions. They're not related, but one is about Cuba and the reality and the extent of what they're doing in a non-pesticide or an organic manner. What's that all about? That's my first one.
As you know, and actually Peter has worked more on this than I, but as you know, in 1989 there was a collapse of the relations with the Soviet bloc, so about 80% of the pesticide imports and fertilizers and petroleum dropped from the Soviet blocs into Cuba. Cuba, however, had one advantage over many of the other developing countries in Latin America, was that it has about 2% of the Latin American population, but 11% of the scientists. So they were very, very quickly able to move all that human resource capacity to promote biological approaches to agriculture that do not rely on chemical pesticides. And there has been a tremendous transformation of the agriculture, the conversion of the Cuban agriculture into these methods of biologically intensive managed systems.
And are they able to feed their people?
Yes.
I would say that the statistics show that, well, before the collapse of the Soviet bloc, Cuba had the best-fed people in Latin America. When the collapse came, food consumption dropped 30%, and they were eating better only than Bolivia and Haiti. Now, 4 or 5 years later, they're back up to the level of consumption they had before, but the fertilizer and pesticide imports are not back up. And in fact, last year, with only a tiny fraction of the agrochemicals they used to use, they had all-time record harvests in 11 of the 13 basic food crops that they produce on the island. So it sort of destroys the myth that we need all those chemicals in order to feed the population. Yes, the transition hurt, and people were hungry for a few years, but they were able to turn it around based on self-reliance and ecological principles, and really at this point, I think, is a model for the rest of the world to study very closely.
Now, don't we hear about food shortages and rationing in Cuba?
Absolutely. That's pretty much, though, in the past. That was in the time period of 1990 to about 1995-96. Right now, from late 96 through 1997, pretty much that situation is in the past. There's still occasional shortages, and people may not find exactly the food item they want on the day they want it, but in terms of their consumption of calories and protein, they're back up to being close to the top in Latin America, and it's really, I mean, it's an amazing turnaround.
Okay, the second question I had, McGill, this business of the Green Revolution, it's almost like there. I come across two separate traditions or discourses. On the one hand, if you go to the internet and you click on Green Revolution, you're going to see paeans of praise to the Green Revolution, and this has happened in India. India's exporting grains and all this good stuff, hybrids. Then, if you go to the alternative view, and you hear Vandana Shiva, who's been on the show before. And then it's horrible. The Green Revolution, it's the multinationals, they're colonizing the people, they're disrupting local food. She said, for example, there are different colored grains that are discriminated against, almost like different colored people, and there's a preference for a white rice as opposed to some other grain, the name of which I don't know, but it has been historically common in India. And so how do we put together the pluses of the Green Revolution, starting with the Rockefeller-sponsored kinds of experiments, Borlaug, I guess his name, he got the Nobel Prize. Can you give us a report card here, plus and minus?
Well,
put it in context so I can match the Borlaug and Vandana Shiva. How do we fit these two together?
Okay. It's a good question, and I think I can answer it because I'm now a chairman of a board, chairman of an NGO committee of the CGIAR. You see, the CGIAR is the Consultative Group of International Agricultural Research. There are 16 centers in the world that have been initially, you know, CIMIT and IRI, the Rice Research Institute and the Wheat and Maize
Institute. Basically, the managers of the Green Revolution.
Yeah, those were the original centers. Now we have 16.
Okay, so these are the Rice Center?
The Rice Center in the Philippines, mm-hmm. and the one in Mexico, the CIMIT, which is the Maize and Wheat Centers.
That's where the Green... Costa Rica or something.
No,
Costa Rica.
That's another one, Cartier.
But okay. It's not part of the CGIAR.
Okay.
Now there are 16 centers, okay? So the Rockefeller and Ford Foundation sent a mission back in the 1940s to Mexico to see how they could modernize agriculture. And the idea was that to create high-yielding varieties that could thrive and produce record yields in order to solve the problems of hunger and malnutrition. The whole argument was a Malthusian argument, saying that because there was hungry is because there was too much people and very little food. And we needed to close that gap between population and food, and the way to do that was to transfer technology from the north to the south. Well, there was one professor from Berkeley, which is Sauer.
George Sauer.
Who was a geographer, who went on that mission, and he wrote a minority report. And he said in that report, if we're going to transfer Iowa corn production systems to Mexico, this is what's going to happen. He predicted basically everything that happened, that there was going to be displacement of local varieties, like Vandana Shiva says, that there's going to be loss of traditions, that there's going to be problems of hunger, that all the problems that have emerged, environmental problems and so on. And he was removed from that committee, and they were replaced by the chairman of agronomy from Cornell. And so the Green Revolution started. What the Green Revolution did, it not only replaced varieties, but it also replaced suppressed knowledge. It changed one knowledge for the other. And, for example, the knowledge that was suppressed was the farmer's knowledge, and also was what the other kind of knowledge that was suppressed was the social sciences knowledge. And it was highly a highly technological determinist type of revolution in which the problem of hunger was only seen as a problem of food production technology that had to be transferred in order to solve the problem. Obviously, after 50 years of the Green Revolution, hunger continues and is even more profound now than before, and the genetic erosion that has happened in terms of traditional varieties has sped up rather than slowed down.
Okay, we'll stop right there. We are talking to Miguel Altieri and Peter Rossett from Food First. We're going to come right back.